All right, so thank you for asking me to do this talk. I'm thrilled to be doing it. And this was the title, as I think Mark gave it, and I decided not to muck with it because that's probably what you wanted to hear about. So as Louise described it the other day, I primarily study the original Earth-like planet. And one of the things that we're bridging that gap between exoplanets and Earth, is what is it that makes a planet habitable? And there's a lot of different ways to think about what habitable is, but ultimately it comes down to requiring some sort of accounting of water and carbon at the surface of the planet. And those of us who look at interior dynamics of a planet will often start to discuss things like carbon and water exist at the surface of the planet by permission of the mantle. And so what I want to do today is start to talk about what is it as some of those mantle processes that allow for carbon and water at the surface so that we can start to think about what is a habitable planet. Now, habitable has a very wide range of possibilities. This is right now. I'm thrilled to be doing this talk in person. But it is a reminder that when we're talking about habitable, we do have potentially quite a bit of wiggle room, but we need to think about what the interior of that planet is and how far we can push it to get there. I have a rule of thumb when giving a talk about to an audience that is not mineral physicists, and my rule of thumb is that I don't use more than two mineral names in the entire talk. And today I'm going to violate that. So anytime I have a mineral, there's also going to be a picture that goes with it. So this is a picture of olivine, and Razvan, if you were here for his talk this morning, showed a nearly identical image, where this is a chunk of the Earth's mantle. And it's been torn off by volcanic processes and brought up to the surface. And this is a piece of what we think the Earth's upper mantle looks like. And it's dominated by this mineral, olivine. And it's called olivine because it's olive green. And that is most of this green mineral that's in this rock here. And the tie between the Earth's interior composition, the Earth's overall composition, is very closely linked to that of the Sun through the process of condensation of planets. And I'm going to work very hard to dance around the specific problem of condensation and how planets are built, and particularly terrestrial planets, and how we end up with the exact composition that we do, except to say that for the vast majority of the elements on the periodic table, our elemental composition is really, really, really close to chondrites, which is really, really, really close to the Sun. And there are outliers that we understand as a consequence of something like condensation. This overhead I stole directly from Tuesday, by the way. So this is the identical overhead. So we have outliers because of problems of condensation. But for the most part, the chondrites and the Sun are really similar. And so I'm going to capitalize on that where I can to look at then stellar compositions to infer something about planetary compositions and potentially some consequences on the dynamics. So, quick Earth science primer. The Earth is divided into two major layers. The Earth, we heard about lots of layers this morning. There's two layers. There's the core, and then there's everything else, the silicate part. All right. So the Earth's core, there's details like the inner part is solid and the outer part is liquid. The Earth's core is made out of iron with nickel and some light elements that can be taken from a long laundry list of the element of the decade. And these are largely hidden from direct sampling. So what's in the core is really is hidden from us, and we need to infer what's there through looking at things like the cores of asteroids. We need to look at inferences, and we can do it by mass balance of inference of the overall planet composition and sampling of the silicate portion of the planet. And so this is a ceramic. You know, you can think of this, if you're a ceramic engineer, you can think of the mantle as a ceramic, or you can think of it as that green rock that I showed you at the beginning. And when we look at that composition of the silicate Earth, we see large variations from chondrites, from meteorites, what we feel is fairly undifferentiated, unperturbed from the early formation process of the solar system. And there's large excursions from the chondrites. And we can, some of this we can understand quite clearly. Some of these large excursions are due to the fact that these are elements that we now infer are hidden from us in the core. Other excursions are, they're partially hidden from us. They're also reacting to the core. My color coding is dependent upon this. And then others of these are, they're volatile. We have a planet that's been had a very hot, brutal beginning, and we've lost some of these elements. But, and where I'm going to focus today is on the major element composition of the silicates, the things like magnesium and silicon and calcium and aluminum, which make up the vast majority of the Earth's mantle, and also very reliably reflect the composition of chondrites, and therefore very reliably reflect the composition of our sun. You guys are very passive so far. Okay. All right. So, within the Earth, within the solid Earth mantle, we have solid state convection that's occurring. The Earth's interior is hot, but because the rock can deform some slowly through time, hot rock can rise towards the surface, and cold rock at the surface can sink back into the interior. On Earth, this happens as plate tectonics, right? So the surface scum of the Earth is formed through partial melting of the mantle. The Earth's mantle is hot. As it comes up to the surface, the pressure on that rock drops, and the temperature of the rock will then cross the melting temperature. And as the melting temperature drops due to the decreasing pressure, and you will form a small amount of partial melt. And that's what's happening under the seafloor today, under the ocean, at the seafloor in the middle of the oceans. We have the creation of new crust through partial melting of the mantle. This is then becomes our oceanic plate, and it sinks back down into the interior. And this is one of the controlling driving forces of plate tectonics.
And if I may interrupt.
Please.
It took me a while to realize, you said the mantle was solids. You have convection in the solids.
It is a solid state convection.
So is it working like a glass more or less, or very viscous liquid?
Extraordinarily viscous.
But isn't it a solid on the time scale of earthquakes, but a fluid on megayear time scale?
So it is a solid.
Okay.
It is a solid. It behaves elastically on very short time periods,
okay.
Right? So earthquakes pass through it. it behaves fluidly over long time periods.
Should we see pitch or things like that?
Think like a glacier. Actually, is an excellent example.
A silly putty.
Or silly putty is another excellent example. So the time scale that you switch from elastic to plastic with silly putty is about a quarter of a second.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that calculation.
whereas
the time scale of switching from elastic to plastic of the Earth's mantle depends on how deep you are, but it's something like 30 to 100 years.
Okay.
So if you push on it briefly, it will respond elastically. If you press on it over long time periods, it behaves plastically. And we have some fairly direct measurements of that sort of thing. Like you can put, a few kilometers worth of ice onto the northern hemisphere for, 100,000 years. When you melt it, it turns out that what happened is that ice pushed down into the mantle and is ever so slowly responding and rebounding afterwards. And you see that in the fjords, for instance, as a consequence of that.
It's rising slowly.
It's slowly rising. Yeah.
Are there measured responses to the magnitude 9 earthquakes?
It's got a ways.
Yes, there's measurement. You can measure viscous responses to magnitude 7 earthquakes.
The reason why you have partial melt near the surface is because there is no temperature equilibration, right? So this stuff rises very quickly.
Quickly on the time scale that it takes to get the heat out. Yeah. So it's these are creeping flows. Everything is moving at the rate of a few centimeters per year. Our typical plate motions are at the rate of a few centimeters per year across the surface of the Earth. And that reflects the interior creeping speed. And so if you think about rock that's taking kind of a round trip, from a mid-ocean ridge down and back up, it's, depending on what number you use, about 500 million years.
The fundamental reason is that the adiabat, the temperature profile, it crosses the solidus where you start to melt. And as long as material is moving upwards along that adiabat, it will eventually intersect that solidus.
Mm.
Yeah. But like, if you move it away from that, the temperature is going to be a lot lower. I'm thinking about if you have magma. Where you have magma.
Sure. Then that changes everything. Once you form melt and the melt separates and moves to the surface, then of course that contributes cooling.
Yeah, maybe for this crowd, it's important to point out that that process is happening very close to the surface. The Earth's mantle is 3,000 kilometers thick. That melt is happening, within the top 50 kilometers. If you go to Hawaii, maybe it extends a little bit deeper.
But you need 1,000 degrees to melt that.
So this is bringing, so what you do is you separate the Earth's lithosphere. This stuff that's colored green and blue here are heat only transfers through that conductively. And so that there's a conductive profile through there. But what happens as we pull apart the lithosphere, as we pull it apart and we bring the mantle up towards the surface, you have effectively that adiabat temperature come up to the surface.
Yeah, so in that place you have 1,000 degrees, but if you dig a hole 50 kilometers deep, a little bit to the left or to the right, the temperature is much lower.
Yes, because there's a small conductive layer. It thickens as you go away from that. Yeah, it's conductive until you get down to the convecting portion of the planet, at which point you get to an adiabat temperature. Okay? All right. Okay. One thing I want to point out, though, is one of the parts that helps control our plate tectonics is that when this rock partially melts up at the surface, it forms basalt, and it was that black stuff in that first picture that I showed you guys. And it floats on top of the mantle. That's why it sits on the top and it's not underneath. But when you push it down a little ways, you get the subduction process started, It goes through what's called the basalt eclogite transition. The minerals that are in that basalt transform into something that is more dense than the surrounding mantle, and it starts to sink it as something that is negatively buoyant. So you have something here, you get it down just a little ways, and it will start to sink through simply through buoyancy. And this is one of the driving forces of plate tectonics.
And is that unique to our surface pressure? Like, to, if I triple the mass of the planet or something, does the fact that this is occurring sort of near...
Okay, so where I'm gonna, I have plotted everything as a function of pressure, right? And so where that depth is, it happens, is gonna vary according to your planet. But the pressure is the pressure. So this is a thermodynamically controlled process where I'm going to have structural transformations in the stable minerals that is controlled by pressure and temperature.
Yeah, so I trust that you're smart enough to have done it in a way that's right. But what I don't is I'm not smart enough to translate pressure into, if I had a planet that were five times more massive, would that cause these processes not to work?
It's not hugely sensitive. Little chi is what matters. And little chi, of course, is the mass. Scales is the mass over radius squared. So that roughly is mass to one third. Roughly.
Because it depends much more on...
This is a consequence of pressure, temperature, and composition.
Yeah, temperature matters. Actually, temperature is probably more important because when you go to... exoplanets, temperature could go all over the place. But since you were asking about pressure, I was answering that specific question, and the answer is, think about little g, don't think about mass.
Well, I'm really asking...
Little g only scales roughly as mass to one third.
Is the viability of this mechanism, where you have things rising, reaching cooling, and then sinking again, is that unique, or at least sort of sensitive to the temperature and pressure of the Earth near its surface?
The depth at which this is going to happen is going to be dependent on the size of your planet. How much this matters, if you have a smaller planet so that this transition occurs deeper, that could potentially turn it off. If it's happening more shallowly, that's an interesting question because it might be easier. There's all sorts of other things with a larger planet that get in the way.
As Dave was saying, it was very dependent on temperature. And therefore, on a bigger planet, G is larger, so you're going to get to it at a shallower depth. And presumably, for a planet with the same surface temperature, it will be at a cooler temperature on a bigger planet.
So it's, except that if you have something that's hotter, you're going to have a greater degree of melt that happens here, which is going to shift this composition, the density, as a consequence of the composition. It's not obvious to me.
I think it's a mistake to focus on this. Because there's a whole list of things.
This is just
one of them. This phase transition is a little unusual in that it's kinetically determined. So it's not a simple phase transition the way we think about lower mantle to upper mantle, things like that. It's complicated. But anyway.
All right, good. Let's move on. All right. So one of the things I wanted to address was this issue of the dynamics of the mantle. And plate tectonics, as Dave would say, is a complicated question. You need to answer 26 questions. Do you have 26? Before you can answer the question of why you have plate tectonics. Right. But what you need to have is this dynamic motion in the mantle. That much I think we can agree on. That's fairly close to the top of your list, right? And the dynamics of the mantle is hot because the Earth formed hot through a variety of different sources of heat, and because it's continuing to cook itself through the radioactive decay of uranium, thorium, and potassium. And whether or not a mantle is going to deform in this solid state convection, or whether or not it's going to convey its heat up towards the surface conductively, is based on whether or not it's in is beyond this critical Rayleigh number, which is just a balance of how easy it is for a system to get its heat out through moving, solidly deforming the material, versus through conducting it. So the Rayleigh number is dependent on all sorts of number of things. You keep asking about five Earth masses. G is in there. That's for you. Actually, it's in there. It's part of the calculation.
But so is D.
Sorry?
So is D.
And D is the layer thickness to the fifth power, okay? So this is a huge portion of the problem, right? Your five Earth mass or five RIT mass, right? So D is probably the more important part in there. And we can get involved in a discussion later as to how much of a planet can be core and how much of it can be mantle, because that's what that also controls D. But, you know, not to worry about the thing that's in the fifth power, I'm going to concentrate on some of the other properties, and this is what motivates me to talk to you guys today, which is tying the composition of the planet to the state of the interior of a planet. And so for just about everything that I am doing, I am imagining an Earth-like planet, which means that it is the mass of the Earth, it is the radius of the Earth, and the core size is the same. Okay? So there's so many bazillion planets out there. I'm imagining that one, and I'm going to focus on one variable at a time. Right? And the variable I want to look at is the heat-producing elements. Okay, these are very, very minor elements in the Earth's mantle. Yeah?
How much, how precise is the amount of these elements in the mantle?
Where's Bill? He's not here. He's on a phone conference.
are these measurements?
No, Bill actually is not here. Works on measuring neutrinos. If this works, and they're getting to that point, they will determine how many beta decays will occur on this planet in the global scale. And this challenging, and in 10, 20 years, we'll know a good answer within 20, 30.
So now it's what, 400 plus or minus? 4 or plus or minus 400?
That's a minus of 400.
No. There is a factor of 3 difference between different groups that have published in the last few years on essentially the sum total.
Hmm. Yeah.
Bill says you can describe it as 10, 20, or 30.
That's the total flux of heat that's produced.
The total, yeah.
But the ratios are more sticky.
No.
The
uranium thorium ratios are fairly stable. But when you throw potassium in there, then it gets a little more variable through time. And that's measurement time, not Earth time.
So these numbers are estimated from the heat flux?
They're estimated from rock chemistry. They're measured from rock chemistry. There's, you know, looking at something like geoneutrinos is given independent way of measuring the uranium and thorium, but not the potassium, because the geoneutrinos can't measure the potassium.
And what they are, under the distribution side.
Yeah.
I'm noticing part per billion, part per billion, part per billion, part per million. Why do you care about the billions?
Because they produce more heat. So this is just a calculation of the heat produced, and this is a stupid unit. I'm sorry about it, but the heat produced per kilogram. If and I also don't like my axes. I'm going to criticize my own talk. So you guys don't
kilogram of Earth.
Kilogram of Earth.
Earth mantle.
Silicate Earth.
Silicate Earth. Okay.
So, and this is the present, and this is going back through time. OK? Okay, just to get that clear. And this puts us here at about, and I looked up the number before I came, and I can't remember what it was, something like 15 or 20 terawatts is the present day heat production from the Earth. And this, so this is the sun total, and you can see the effect of the half-life of potassium being a little bit shorter than that of uranium. And thorium's got, like, you know, it's the Energizer bunny because it's just kind of chugging along there. Maybe it's a little engine that could. It's a 14 billion year half-life. So it's constantly producing.
So you mean that half 100 heat flux is due to this?
So if you take the total, it's like 44 terawatts out of the planet, present day. And, you know, like half of it's primordial and half of it's from the mantle and half of it's from the crust. And the excess there is in the uncertainties. Right?
You don't get, a trivial amount from coming out of any different, freezing of the core is not significant.
No, it is.
The core is now thought to be significant. So
yeah.
That is so because you have to run the dynamo, and so you can calculate. Well, it's tricky. There are some issues in doing that calculation, but it could be 15 terawatts. By cooling, not because there are intrinsic heat sources.
Okay.
But the abundances are independent of the heat. The estimates of the abundances are independent of the heat measured because there's a factor of two difference, roughly.
The abundance measurements that I showed you. Okay, so this curve is based on the numbers on the previous plot, the previous figure, which are based on geochemical measurements.
And with uranium and chondritic measurements for uranium and thorium or not?
You gotta be a little bit careful there because chondritic is then for the silicate earth is separated into the mantle and the crust. And actually a lot of this is concentrated into the crust. Anytime you partially melt a rock, uranium and thorium don't play well with solids. And so they go into the liquid and they end up in the crust. And so that concentrates a lot of the heat production into the earth's crust, which is why I said half, half, and half of these. Just because, you know, at this point, the estimates for how you partition our 44 terawatts has been doing this,
doing it more or less independently. That is to say, the geochemists are not looking over the shoulder of the geophysicists most of the time. They're just doing their thing as well as they can and getting a number, and the geophysicists, of course, measure the heat flow, which, by the way, has also changed. It's sort of stabilizing now, but when I first got involved in the subject, it was down at 30. That was the number quoted in the mid-70s. That just shows you how much these numbers have changed. It's now 44, or maybe 45. I would go for 40.
What's your favorite number?
It doesn't matter. So when people talk about half of it being due to radioactivity, that's not because they're trying to fit some theoretical concept. They're actually trying to measure it.
Right.
But of course, the measurement's imperfect. A lot of it is concentrated in the crust. A small amount in the mantle. You have to believe that the mantle is homogeneous. You have to believe there's no radiating heat sources in the core. There are all sorts of caveats.
But couldn't you get the numbers, the bulk abundances in Earth of uranium and thorium from looking at a chondrite?
You would get close. Among the geochemists, there are actually disagreements on this point, but you might.
Uranium and thorium would be more or less straightforward. Potassium would be tricky.
Potassium's a red herring. But so one of the difficulties is figuring out exactly how much of it is sequestered in the crust, because there's a deep crust that we don't get very reliable samples of. And a lot of that, you know, if a geochemist needs a garbage can, they're going to put it in the deep crust.
There's another thing is that Earth is not chondritic.
They're all the same.
And then there's that problem, too.
Been arguing that.
Yeah, the Earth is not concrete.
And there, if you look at the different chondritic meteorites, you see differences in the abundances of these elements. So.
Yeah. All right, so now that I've made the case that we know the Earth so well, let's move on. And one of the things that I've been thinking about in the last couple of years is what the impact of compositional variations in stars in the galaxy would have on any terrestrial exoplanets that exist around those stars. And so this is me plotting the Atabekian, but since I cannot make heads or tails of element over H in square brackets, but I can add and subtract logarithms. And so this is me recalculating as a geochemist. And I'm not a geochemist. But this is a geochemistry plot because, so this is number, this is moles. Not by weight, this is number of atoms of aluminum per silicon and the number of atoms of magnesium per silicon. And this is based off of the database that I downloaded from here, for which some number of those stars have detected planets around them. These are not small planets necessarily. These are not, you know, something that we know to be Earth mass or size. This is just, there was a planet around there and I found it in the database. And what is striking to me is that the variation in magnesium silicon and also in aluminum silicon is fairly wide. And this is very small to an astronomer. Were you guys, you worried about order of magnitude variation? And a factor of 2 is a radically different mineralogy. If I take an assemblage of magnesium, silicon, and oxygen, and I change my magnesium, silicon, oxygen ratio by a factor of 2, I now have a different mineral. I have a completely different rock. And this is part of what's motivating me. Yeah, so for people that think square brackets, I did this a couple of days ago, so it's up to date.
No.
But first, let's look at the trace element effect. Okay, so we don't have to worry about minerals. I'm going to wait till you're really run down before introducing a lot of mineral names. Yeah.
I'm a little confused by the numbers on the x-axis as well as y-axis. Some numbers below 1 is 8, 9, 10, and so on. What's that?
It's on a log scale.
This is
0.9, 0.9, 0.8.
Yeah, that's a decimal.
It's on a log scale there.
All right.
Yeah.
And that uncertainty is what? Is that 1 sigma or? I mean,
whatever it is, I don't believe it.
It's not. The range is not that much bigger than the uncertainty, and that's depending on.
Yeah.
For ratio, yeah. I'd buy them.
Yeah.
For an absolute value, I wouldn't pay for the differential.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was more appropriately directed backwards.
And when chondrites are the same as the solar atmosphere, that's on a big plot, and excluding lithium and the volatiles, what is the real range? I mean, you know, there are factors of 2 for some things.
Yeah, yeah. So oxygen is an outlier on here because your volatility becomes an issue. The error bars are large, right? Or fairly large, but you know, these are.
This large error bar certainly is coming from photosphere measurement, not from rock.
Yes, but.
Yeah, but if you're asking about magnesium to silicon in chondritic meteorites, that's a narrow range.
Yeah, that is a very
it's
narrow.
It's not all one number, but it's a narrow range.
Yeah. I'm just a little concerned that you're not going to be able to really know what's in those bodies because the measurements of stars are not as good as
Well, then prove your measurement.
This is why we're having a discussion on precision stellar astrophysics.
Yeah, because actually one of our motivating questions here, to be honest, is it important for us to get enough precise numbers, right? In other words, are there problems for which it actually matters that we get the bulk nebulosity to very high precision? Because if there are, it might be.
Or the abundance ratios, yes.
Well, the abundance ratios.
I mean, certainly it's good that we get the radii of stars to better than we were getting them a few years ago.
But they need the numbers, the ratios at least, to high accuracy, not just high precision.
Yes, yes. I realize this is a tough problem.
But that may be doable. The ratios.
But I think the question that she's going to address is basically at what level does it really matter?
Yeah, it matters.
At least one day
to the
morning.
Yeah,
right, and that's
yeah, and that's really, yeah, thank you. I'm not going to show you this is the result for this star, for this planet, because there's nothing that was really high enough believability on mass, radius, composition, or anything else. Okay, so graduate student of mine and Jennifer Johnson's here has taken up the task of measuring how much thorium varies in some of these stars. And so he looked and he developed a, I don't know if you can call 20 stars a catalog, found 20 stars for which he could measure the thorium variation in solar analogs, those that have with and without detected planets.
What does it mean, analog?
What's that?
What is the analog?
With a solar analog. It looks like the sun in size and age.
Were you asking about the arrow or the analog?
Oh, it's analog.
It's a definition of solar analog.
Solar analog.
A star that's the same age and size.
Looks like, within metallicity, temperature, and gravity. So you can build one line list for this part of the spectrum, and you can reliably take it from
the solar. So that's really not analog.
Analogs. There weren't
analogs. Analogs.
We did not reject solar twins, but this
sunlight star.
It's
sunlight.
Yeah.
I think you're actually seeing them by the spectrum.
You're looking at the spectrum. Yeah. Well, see, the thing is that I don't think you've ever seen the spectrum before, right? So you can't tell what looks similar, what doesn't. So valid question.
When I look at these all look identical. Is that what I'm supposed to derive, or you say there's a difference?
Yes.
Well, so right here is the thorium line.
Yeah. They all look identical.
They're slightly different. I've got a different plot. They're slightly different, but yes, this was not an easy task. And this maybe highlights why there wasn't, when I first asked how much does thorium vary, I really couldn't find very much information on it, because it's actually not routinely measured. So he measured them. And so now we're back into ratio space. But so the measure of the amount of thorium in the star compared to the amount of iron in the star for the suite of stars that he looked at, and he finds actually a significant variation in the amount of thorium. Yeah.
Given that your thorium line lies on the shoulder of the broad iron line, don't you worry that you have this type of correlation? Maybe.
The iron line. It turns out you could do crazy things with the iron line, and in that these are HARP spectra a lot of the time, 100,000 resolution. So it just didn't. I mean, so, I was skeptical.
But we also have a correlation with silicon.
Yeah.
What is epsilon?
So
epsilon is it's related to the square bracket.
Yeah.
It's the abundance on a logarithmic scale where hydrogen is naturally enough 12.
Yeah, I looked at. I have to look it up every time, but because I was talking to a bunch of stellar people, I didn't look it up today.
That's right.
Yeah. And so he also finds the same variation relative to silicon, and the silicon variability is actually a little bit more important than iron, because the silicon abundance, in fact, controls how big your mantle is. So if you have thorium varying with iron, that just says, so thorium in my mantle varying with how big my core is, that's not very instructive. But this actually suggests that if there are planets, terrestrial planets, forming around these stars, their mantles are going to be 3 times of abundant of our uncertain measurement of thorium in our mantle, but 3 times as abundant because it's highly refractory element. It doesn't react with iron. It's going to be in the silicate earth or silicate plant, terrestrial planet. And so this then suggests a fairly significant variability between these planets as a consequence of stellar variability in something that's in the part per billion concentration range.
I guess I don't follow this. Well, why are you not relying on the thorium to silicate ratio as the relevant measure?
I am relying as the thorium
silicate
ratio.
Is that the factor of three? Or?
That's a factor of three variability.
It looks to me like... That's where do you see the factor three from? From the point of the bottom left, everything else?
From here to here.
No, yeah, but that's not,
basically,
that's
there's the left one left weird left point.
Left. Look at the right.
Yeah, left. So no. So here's the sun.
Okay.
The square, sorry, triangle is the sun.
What is the best line then?
This, okay, so we've done a couple of fits. So these are the, you know, correlation by thumbprint, right, that we were talking about yesterday. So take these out and just look at the correlation between there. That's the straight line. This is the fit to all the data.
But then it's a 20%.
The points at 7.6 are the range you're talking about, so it's the sun to the things up above that are silicon but varying thorium, the width there.
So, and it's not exactly a one-to-one, but it is highly correlated.
Which is, you know, perhaps not surprising because you're overall more metal rich.
Is it thorium enrichment or silicon depletion?
That's a good question, and it is thorium enrichment. If anything, the sun looks depleted relative to these other stars.
But the slope is less than one.
Yes.
Does one have significance here, or is that just?
It depends on your understanding of why these things vary, right? So that's a consequence of how stars are polluted and how things mix and so forth, and that is so far beyond my purview. Yeah, okay. So what we've done then is look at this variation in thorium and spend some time contemplating what the impact is on the heat budgets, these uncertain heat budgets in the Earth, but the variability ought to be comparable in other terrestrial planets. And what we would suggest then is that, you know, you can produce dynamics in a mantle over significantly longer timescales, or you can produce dynamics in a mantle in a smaller planet to help counteract that d to the fifth term.
Okay. Oh, so the other thing that obviously comes to my mind is the aluminum 26, if you assume that it also is enhanced in metal-rich stars, might completely change the accretion process if things are molten.
We could talk about that changing the accretion process or the initial, never mind. I spent some time getting that to look okay and it didn't. It changes your initial conditions of the planet. Yeah. there was another slide that overhead there, like doing a stupid simple calculation on dynamics, but it looks really bad. So, but the upshot is that you can get a smaller planet to live a little bit longer, or a planet that's Earth size to live quite a bit longer. And particularly if you take that thorium and uranium ought to vary together, if I have a factor of three variation in uranium as well, that has a significant impact in the heat budget for a terrestrial planet.
What do you mean, live longer?
So be able to maintain interior dynamics over a longer time period. All right. Okay? All right. So now I'm going to look at this with all the healthy skepticism on whether or not each data point is meaningful but as a range. Yeah.
How much of the thorium variations might be due to the age of the stars? Because stars are around that we see for
But these are all stars that are about the same age as this one.
I doubt you really know that.
Huh?
I doubt you really know
I think they're about
It's a 14. It's a 14 and a 14 billion half-life. 14 billion year half-life.
Okay.
Came and tried to, it just,
We tried to push that one as far as we could. It doesn't push very hard.
It's the astrophysics of does the thorium stay in the photosphere in your heaven? So does the thorium stay in the photosphere, or does it somehow settle out over billions of years?
Not much. It's a 10% level effect for the sun. So it might be 20% in an old disk star. If you looked at hot stars, you actually really have to start worrying about strange variations in the surface abundances, but you mostly don't see exoplanets in the hot stars.
And the meteorites in thorium and the sun agreed quite well on thorium.
But in any case, that would affect even less the ratio, right? Mm-hmm. So the silicon would settle more or less at the same speed as thorium, so the ratio would be more or less kept.
Yeah, and the sun. If you go to the hotter stars, it goes crazy because of the gravitation and stuff.
All right, major elements. Now I'm going to consider the magnesium silicon ratios and the. I have considered aluminum silicon as well, but today I'm really just going to focus on the effect of variable magnesium silicon ratios, and these vary from about, about a factor of two in either way. What dawned on me earlier today is that I'm going to flip this ratio on you in a moment. So it's going to be silicon over magnesium, but one half and two are just flip-flopped, exactly. So I apologize on doing that. Okay, which brings me to minerals. So here's what I have. There are probably 50 minerals I could discuss when discussing the Earth's mantle in a variety of different ways. Sometimes they're the same thing, but with a different name, and sometimes they're the same chemical composition, but because they're a different structure, they have a different name. So I'm going to focus on just a couple of minerals here. Olivine, that was the one that I showed you at the beginning. It is olive green. And at high pressure, that olivine structure changes form. So just like graphite converts into diamond at high pressure, olivine becomes beta olivine or gamma olivine, but those also beta comes with a name that we could call it wadsleyite, and gamma comes with a name we can call it ringwoodite. I will call it green. Okay. And what you need to know about olivine is that it can hold some water, and particularly when it is beta or gamma. I will slip into wadsleyite ringwoodite because they are wadsleyite and ringwoodite friends. But they can hold some amount of water. And they are, when I started off in saying that the Earth's surface water lives by permission of the mantle, this is predominantly how that water is being stored. At 25 gigapascals in the Earth, that's 660 kilometers below the surface, the pressure is too much for any polymorph of olivine, and it breaks down into two other minerals, bridgmanite and ferroperoclase. So bridgmanite is going to be with a bridge. Bridgmanite is the new name for what you might know as perovskite. Sorry.
We would call it type 1 and type 2, so.
Okay. So this is stable above 25 gigapascals and is stable for the rest of the thick depth of the mantle. And I'm just not going to look at Rosbon when I say that. This is also known as magnesium silicate perovskite. Okay. What you need to know about bridgmanite is that it doesn't hold water, and it's really stiff. So when it comes to deforming it in that mantle convection process, it's stiff. Ferroperoclase, which you might have heard referred to as magnesioleucite, is MGFBO. What you need to know about it is it doesn't hold water, and it's pretty weak. Okay, it flows relatively readily. Garnet, this is the same garnet that you're going to wear in jewelry. All right, so here's my garnet. In some cases, garnet is deep red. That tends to be what is sold as jewelry. It comes by a variety of different names. There's more. I didn't even include them all. It holds a little water. It's like the glass half empty kind of mineral. Glass half full kind of mineral. It holds a little bit, but not a whole lot. It also breaks down into bridgmanite, but at slightly higher pressures. Okay, so here's the Earth's mantle, the Earth's mantle mineralogy. And I'm doing this as a function of pressure, which just means that if you have a bigger planet, all this is going to come up closer to the surface. Phase boundaries change a little bit depending on how the temperature varies as well, including if I bring the temperature down low enough, new phases will appear. If I bring it up higher, I'm going to change the relative abundances of each one, but not for our purposes, not a huge amount. Okay, so here's the olivine phases, alpha, beta, and gamma. Here is bridgmanite, which you might know as perovskite. Ferropericlase takes up about 10 to 15% of the Earth's lower mantle in the Earth. And here's garnet. It starts to take on more and more of that which is in the mantle, and it tends to be gone by about 30 GPa.
So there's some other things in the bottom left?
Yeah. If I didn't give it a picture, I'm not going to talk about it. Don't worry about it.
There's other things near the surface that are irrelevant.
They're relevant depending on what you're looking at. For my story today, I'm not going to worry about it. But they're going to show, they're going to expand, they're going to contract depending on composition.
Well, that ends the title.
Yeah, this is orthopyroxene, which we call anthotite, clinopyroxene, but I can call all sorts of different things, but I'm not going to do that to you. Okay. And there's even things here that I haven't even bothered to label. Okay. So back to this dynamics of the Earth. One of the things that I want to address then is this consideration of the mantle viscosity, that eta. So how readily it deforms. And one way that we can think about the viscosity of a mineral is based on its strength with regard to shear stress as normalized. This is a shear stress that's normalized to a shear modulus. And everything varies with temperature. And this is the melting temperature of the material divided by the temperature at which you're making that measurement. This is flipped up at the top. So temperature, increasing temperature goes this way. Right? So as temperature goes up, things get weaker. That hopefully makes some sense. Garnet is one of the stiffer things that we have here. This is olivine. This is a mineral I don't want you to worry about. Here's what's labeled perovskite because this is a figure that is 4 years old. So this is bridgmanite. And rock salt is the same sort of structure as this ferropericlase, which is significantly weaker. And one of the things that I want to highlight is, in fact, when I add water to any mineral, it gets weaker. So it deforms more readily. So it's in the denominator of the Rayleigh number with a smaller number, which increases the propensity for a mantle to convect. Adding water weakens materials. And so this is one way that I think about this. Here's the four minerals I want you to worry about, is that olivine, which can be wet, is not necessarily wet in the Earth, but it can be wet. And by wet, I put in quotes because it's like a percent of water in there versus dry, where dry can hold maybe 10 parts per million of water. And garnet, like I mentioned, was kind of in between. and they can be weak or strong. And here I've put olivine in the weak category because it contains that water that weakens it. And there's nothing, there's not going to be any minerals really that come up into this portion where something both holds water and is fairly strong. And that's because putting water into a mineral, storing water in a mineral, involves forming hydrogen bonds. So you have to break a cation-oxygen cation bond to make an OH and a hydrogen bond, which is very weak. And so this will tend to almost universally will drop the strength of the material as you add water. So you're not going to find anything up in this range.
So when you say it's a few percent water, what you really mean is that there's OH things somehow mixed into the crystalline structure.
And I goofed because a few percent is by weight. All right, so I take the mass of my olivine and I take count up the number of hydrogen atoms that I have, divide by 2 and multiply by 18 grams per mole, because that's moles of H2O, right? So, and that's my weight percent of that olivine, for instance. But it is not stored in these minerals as water molecules. It is, you take a water molecule and it's individual hydrogen atoms that are in as defects in that crystal. So, you know, Razvan this morning showed these beautiful pictures of crystal structures, which is an idealization. So in reality, there's a lot of defects and errors in the formation of those. And you've, in the gaps, you add in a hydrogen atom. Minerals are close-packed oxygen, really. There's plenty of oxygen around in these minerals. So we can always just refer to that as hydrogen as being something that can always liberate that many moles of water. Okay. So here's what I've done. And these are really quite brand new calculations of trying to think about what happens in just this, you know, the major element variations in mantles that form mantles of terrestrial planets. And this is where, so I have a 0.4 instead of exactly a factor of 2, but this is something that's very depleted in silicon relative to magnesium. This is not dissimilar from when I did an eyeball averaging of thick disk stars. I'm learning all sorts of new terminology this week. I'm not sure what that means, but hopefully you do. And I did an averaging of thick disk stars, which I asked for composition of Kepler 444 and couldn't get one, but told to average thick disk stars. And this is what I get. And what you find is something, a couple fairly interesting features. And it remains to have some discussions with dynamicists and geochemists and so forth to think about exactly what some of the implications of this are. First off, for the Earth, we had ferroperoclase only stable in the lower part of the mantle. Here, it's nearly half of the entire mantle. This doesn't hold water. It is relatively weak. So we have something that can convect and overturn somewhat independent of incorporating water in that mantle, which is a good thing because there's hardly any water storage capacity in this. So if I take the Earth and integrate the total capacity of the mantle to store water, I get an amount of water that's about 10 times the mass of the oceans. And this is this, you know, sleight of a hand mass water. And that's about 10 times the mass of the oceans. The Earth's mantle is most likely undersaturated in water, significantly undersaturated in water. But the total capacity is about 10 oceans worth. This is a mantle that has a total capacity of maybe one ocean, probably less. And that's going to go with all sorts of caveats of things like what the temperature is. If I have a planet that is hotter, the capacity drops. And so you have a capacity that's maybe more like a half or even a quarter, closer to zero. And so we have some interesting features in here in terms of the amount of water storage capacity that we have here. And yet, instead of requiring that I have a relatively weak mineral at the upper mantle for convection, I have that weak mineral in the form of ferropericles.
CF is
what? Oh, calcium ferrite, which is the way that these calculations are done as a global minimization of energy. And you got to have some place to put the sodium. So the calcium ferrite's there because there's sodium in these calculations.
So the boundaries come from free energy calculations?
What's that?
The boundaries here come from free energy calculations.
Yeah. This is all Lars and Carolina's code. Yeah.
Does mostly all the in the mantle just stay in the mantle for giga years? So it's really isolated from the water. The water from the surface is isolated because...
Okay, so you asked two different questions, right? So is the olivine isolated? So presumably, and this is, so the canonical view is that you have a convective overturn in the mantle. And so olivine, as it is brought down deeper in the mantle, the pressure on it is greater, and it transforms to beta olivine, gamma olivine, and will break down to bridgmanite and ferropericles. And then it will come back up, and it will reform. Okay. Does the olivine go with? Does the water go with that? Is another question. It depends on how saturated the mantle is in water, and it depends upon what that nature of that overturn is. Really, how well is the upper mantle mixed with the lower mantle? The lower mantle, it doesn't look like can really hold very much water. Unless we can find one of these hydrous phases that can hold it. The nominally anhydrous phases of the major minerals of the mantle, it doesn't look like any of the lower mantle phases can hold it. One of the, it's not in here, this is one of the uncertainties in there of what can hold water. This is a calcium-structured perovskite, so it still gets called perovskite. And it's very difficult to study experimentally because you can't bring it down to ambient pressure. So there are some suggestions that it can store a lot of water. I'm working on doing calculations to calculate how much it can store, and I'm getting squat.
So what calculations did you refer to when you answered Weisland's questions earlier? You said who's doing the calculation to generate that diagram?
The mineral phase, these phase diagrams comes from Lars and Carolina's Stixrud and Lithgow Bertoloni Hephaesto code.
So they have a database where they compile data coming from calculations and experiments, and then they run the thermodynamics and they come up with this.
Melts.
No,
it's not melts. Melts is for melts.
This is Hephaesto.
This is for solids.
Yeah.
They just got the free energies for different
computers. Yeah, it's based on free energy minimization. It is a largely experimentally determined database. Yeah. Yeah.
The calcium perovskite can put a hold a lot of potassium, uranium.
Yes.
Yeah, that's also in way. Yeah. There's a pair of measurements, just a couple, like two measurements of how to store the thorium and uranium. Actually, it's just uranium is the measurements that are there. That showing that it can hold, we only need to hold a few parts per billion. It can hold it. So that's probably the reservoir for the thorium and uranium in the Earth's lower mantle. Yeah. Where the potassium is a different question. It's probably in that calcium ferrite phase if it's there. Is there another? Yeah. Okay. All right, so this is just the other N number doubling silicon to magnesium. And here is, there's no olivine less than this. So pretty much what I've done is I have a mantle that is so rich in silica. So olivine has a 2-to-1 ratio of magnesium to silicon, and I deplete all of the magnesium out of this mantle, and there's no need to create this olivine. And instead, it is a mantle that is, in fact, saturated in silica. So I have free silica in this mantle. This guy is also stiff, but a bismuthite garnet, and integrating the total capacity of that garnet, I get 0.1 ocean mass of water stored in this planet, and that's just going to go down with a bigger planet.
You're changing only the ratio.
This is just changing the silicon magnesium ratio.
So you decrease magnesium and increase silicon so that the total stays the same.
The amount of mantle.
The total amount of mantle stays the same. Yeah.
When oxygen changes, SiO2 to MgO.
Yes. Yes, the total amount of oxygen changes. So to do this entirely self-consistently, I would have to grow and shrink the core, right? Because that's a reservoir.
Well, my question was actually what Ella asks, why does the curve stop at 35 GPa?
Oh, because it just does this until you get to 120 GPa. So I just cut it off here because this is where the guts of the, I run the calculation all the way up to 140 GPa.
There's no new mineral physics that appears when...
There's no new minerals that appear until you get to post-perovskite in any calculation that I've done, except for alpha lead oxide for the SiO2. I get the alpha lead oxide at about that same pressure.
And then alpha PbO2.
Yeah.
C2C is what?
That's a high temperature phase of the pyroxene.
So, Wendy, can we just ask you to go ahead and finish?
Yes.
How many other slides you've got, and then we'll.
This is the last one.
Right. Welcome to stay, but.
Okay, this is the last one. And this was just, I know that it was going to set Dave off. But the reason that I showed this basalt eclogite transition at the beginning is that when I do this for a 60% enriched mantle, and create a crust through melting it and then compressing it, I never actually get this transition that allows for that crust to become negatively buoyant and continue to sink. And so when we have these discussions of why you have plate tectonics and when can you have plate tectonics on another planet, there's certain compositional constraints that can allow us to skip the first 26 questions. And that was the only point that I really wanted to make with this, is that there are compositional regimes where this is so silica-rich that this is effectively creating your crust as an andesite, which is continental crust. Continental crust doesn't subduct. And this is the calculation that shows that it never can become dense enough to get that negative buoyancy going, to get plate tectonics going. And that was my last slide.
In the silicon poor case, how much iron is in the mantle? I'm curious about the trade-off between the mantle and the core in respect of iron, because if I've got my ferropericlase, I can imagine putting more iron.
Yeah, so I have been very careful to not touch iron ratios in these calculations, because it's a fairly complex question of oxygen availability.
Yeah.
And as you change your oxygen availability, you have a smaller or larger core. And that then increases or decreases comparably the amount of iron in these minerals. So I have very carefully
kept everything. You must have done something in order to even do your calculation.
I've kept everything at forced rate 88. So I've kept that magnesium iron ratio constant every single one of these calculations, because I just had to take that straight line shot through the compositional space to not ever muck with iron, because that's now a condensation question and I didn't want to get involved.
So if you go to the other way around, if you change the silicon magnesium ratio to lower, your first one, what happens?
You get the basalt eclogite transition, It goes up or down in pressure a little bit based on the temperatures that I assume.
So you just move the red bucket and red solid curve together up?
Yeah, they don't change significantly.
If you have avoided the iron question, doesn't that mean that in some sense you've avoided the difficult question of partial melting in these alternative herbs? Because that is the iron affects,
So, in
the silicon pour case, do you even get partial melting when you pressure release the mixture that you have that was
well, you would suggest no, right?
Well, it depends on your adiabat.
So the question is, what are those numbers in that case?
Yeah, so, you know, by keeping myself at a magnesium number, at a constant magnesium number in all these calculations, I was actually really surprised at how little my adiabat would change. And I was fixing my adiabat to that point at which I get 5% melt at the surface.
I think what I'm really getting at is that the solidus, which is what really matters,
the solidus varies a lot, is going to be affected
to some extent by these difficult questions such as iron.
Yeah. The solidus varies a lot, but the point at which I get something where I'm extracting a real crust, which I gave it a simple straight across the board 5% melt, that varied by remarkably little. I was surprised at how little it was, and that was really controlled by that magnesium number.
Yeah, if you're fixing the magnesium number, yeah. And also you're not changing anything else, like some of the volatiles.
But I changed the silicon dramatically in doing that.
Yeah, but I don't think that is not expected to change it dramatically. So I would say that makes sense. I was going to comment on the long-lived radioisotope differences. Actually, from a galactic chemical evolution point of view, we expect there to be variation in that abundance. Not so much because the abundance of thorium and uranium is changing, but the abundance of silicon, magnesium, everything else is changing. Yeah. As the galaxy piles up metals, stable metals, those are essentially diluting out.
Yeah, so maybe it's more of a question of how silicon's evolved in the thorium, but it's going to have
a consequence. So we expect factors of a few of our galactic history. But on the flip side, Edwin Kite and I did this very simple calculations where we varied the amount of the abundance of the radioisotopes, and we found very modest effects on the mantle potential temperature by 50 Kelvin, sort of order of magnitude. Okay. And of course, what the mantle does is it simply adjust itself to get rid of the heat it needs.
And it doesn't need to adjust very much.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of discussion that mantle potential temperature is affixed by melting at the surface, and that the system will evolve towards a fairly consistent potential temperature as fixed by that temperature. Mark?
Yeah, if I think about the kind of trends we see in stellar mixtures, it was one of the most robust is a change in what we call alpha to iron, which is basically iron or heavy group elements to what we basically magnesium, silicon, alphas. And we also have a lot of intrinsic variability in things like carbon and oxygen because they can be produced by other nucleosynthetic sources. So if you want one interesting question to pursue is, we have almost two tiers of this sort of silicon to iron ratio in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. And we actually have some interesting dynamic range of things like carbon and oxygen. So just as a comment, those dimensions would be interesting to explore.
So we've explored the carbon one, but I decided not to wade into that today. I'd be happy to talk to you about it. But so we've looked at carbon because it's the flashiest with some really interesting implications on there.
It could vary by a lot, even by astronomy standards.
What is the range of carbon-oxygen ratio?
It can be orders of magnitude in some sense, right?
If you want to include the bulge and the halo, then you can see C2O's of maybe 0.2 compared to the solar value of about 0.55. So you get a factor of 3 there. But among the stars which we are most familiar with and which are the subject of the planet searches, that's basically almost no variation.
There's an interesting twist on this, because we're getting so many spectra now. That's one question I want to have for you is, right now you do searches and you chase the chemistry afterwards, right? When we're in an era where we have millions of spectra, which we are in an era, we'll get into that now, you can imagine conducting experiments where you know the chemistry and you look for planets and systems with very different chemistry. So,
yeah, because we have like
by chemistry, you're referring to the chemical composition of the star.
Yes. Yeah.
So we have for example, Woody and I have an undergraduate who's looking at the APGE database and is going to plot C/O for all the stars in there. Now, some of that is going to be changed by stellar evolution and or binary interactions or something like that. So we'll have to call it. But the question is, because you know, do we ever get above C/O of 0.8? How low do we go? Because as Mark was saying, AGB stars contribute carbon to the galaxy on a different time scale than core collapse supernova contribute oxygen.
And there are some environments where they can contribute very efficiently, which means there are some subpopulations that are interesting.
Sure.
I will do the talk on this next week.
Great. All right, thank you.